The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chah. On this week's podcast, we delve into the mysteries of the mind. What is and what isn't our brain capable of?
How could we fail to see that eating a piece of lemon is a sharp, angular shape in the hand?
Plus, what's getting in the way of stopping us understanding absolutely everything?
You would need a Large Hadron Collider the size of a galaxy in order to be able to see them.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. This is going to be a show about decisions. How do we make them? What factors influence us? What kind of decisions are we able to make? Neuroscientists are getting increasingly better at working out how complex the processes involved in these things actually are, and how easily those processes can be interfered with. Tackling some of this stuff on a regular basis is Professor Barry Smith, who's the director of the Institute of Philosophy at the University of London. He's also just made a series of programmes for the BBC World Service, starting this week, and he's joined me in the pod to tell me all about it. Let's jump straight in. What's going on in our brains when we recognise a friend?
Well, what we found out is that there's a particular part of the brain, the fusiform gyrus, and a particular part of that fusiform face area, which is always activated when we see a face. Now, you might think, oh, well, if it's on, then we have a conscious experience of a face, and if it's off or damaged, we won't. But it's not as simple as that. You need this part of the brain. It's a component, but by itself, it's not enough to give us face recognition. For example, there are people who've got Capgras syndrome. They've got the ability to recognize faces, fusiform face areas working, but they will say that their familiar loved one has been replaced by an imposter. So they recognize the person, but they say it's just not them. Now, why is that? And it's because a connection is missing between the fusiform face area and the amygdala, part of our emotional system. So if I'm looking at my mother or my wife and I don't get the usual emotional hit, then the only way for the brain to construe it is that's not the person I know.
What about other conditions like face blindness, where obviously people can't recognize other people's faces? I mean, is that the same part of the brain responsible for that?
Yes. This is when there's damage or perhaps a lack of development of this area of the brain, then people are blind to faces. And somehow or other, it's called prosopagnosia, somehow or other they still manage to get around the world, to marry, to interact with people. But they use other clues, especially voice. So when we're talking to each other, we're using face and voice to identify who we're dealing with. And it turns out face and voice are usually connected. I mean, if you're listening to my voice now, you probably have an image in your mind of what I look like because the face area will be lit up. But with people who have damage there, they are using voice or they're using hairstyle or they're using any unusual feature to pick people out.
So what we think of as a very simple thing, recognizing someone's face or recognizing a friend we know, again, quite a complicated set of networks. What about something that might well be simple? What about tasting some food? What's going on there?
Well, taste turns out to be one of the most complicated experiences. Okay, right. Very simple. You pop something in your mouth and you say, yep, tastes like a strawberry. But in fact, taste, or what we call taste, is always using taste, touch, and smell. And in fact, researchers even believe that we're using the eyes and we're even using the ears to give us information about what we're eating.
So what food looks like helps us to taste it, or helps judge how we taste it.
Yes. I mean, if you're given a plate of food in unusual lighting conditions and you're eating it with pleasure, and then the lighting changes and suddenly the food looks blue, you can have a pretty violent reaction to that. So it turns out that your expectations about how something will taste are guided by how it looks. You're using smell, you're using touch. For example, whether a biscuit tastes stale or fresh is only a matter of the textural difference. Every other part of its flavor is the same, but whether it crumbles in the mouth a different way, that's what makes it seem to taste different.
In the programs, you talk about having more than five senses. Now, I've heard of the sixth sense, in inverted commas, the proprioception, there's feeling of where we are in the world. But what are the other 20 or so that you're maybe talking about?
Yes, well, neuroscientists say somewhere between 26 and 33. I mean, you have a sense of balance because of the canals in your ear. You have a sense of where your body is, where your limbs are. You have a sense perhaps of movement. You even have a sense of whether a piece of your body belongs to you. And for some neurological patients, that can go missing. But take smell, for example. We usually think of smell as a single sense, but in fact, there are two senses. There's orthonasal smell, when we're taking things from the environment, smelling smoke, fire, predators. And there's another retronasal smell, which comes from the back of the throat and passes in the other direction across the nose. And that's to assess the quality of the food we've just eaten. It tells us whether there's something good or bad, we want more or we want to eject it. So retronasal smell is different. It's when you exhale, orthonasal smell when you inhale. Now, I can explain to you why these are very different. Think of coffee. Very often, the attraction of coffee is the smell. You think, oh, that wonderful smell of fresh brewed coffee, and you're anticipating a great flavor. But actually, when you taste it, you're a little disappointed. It never really lives up to that aroma. And that's because the retronasal smell doesn't match the orthonasal smell. And then think of other foods like particularly poignant French cheese. If you smell it, you might think, gosh, I'm not putting that in my mouth. It's like sweaty socks. But when you're eating it and the aromas are being processed retronasally, it's quite delicious. So these two senses of smell can work in opposition to one another.
Looking at conditions, sort of psychological and psychiatric conditions can do a lot to explain how the brain is actually wired. So one of the conditions that you looked at in the program was phantom limb syndrome. I think we've got a clip of it.
I can't understand it, but I know in my own experience that this is happening to me. I don't like my phantom limb. I would get rid of it if I could.
We usually talk about my arm, my hand, but I notice you talk about your phantom limb as it.
Yes, although I feel that I've got two arms, I think of it almost as a separate entity, and I call it it. I might call it my phantom, I probably have, but I think there's a contradiction in me that I do speak of it as it, and yet it feels part of me.
So we heard there a lady who has phantom limb syndrome, the idea that even though she doesn't have a particular part of the body anymore, she still feels it there. What's going on in the brain at that point?
Well, I think this shows you that our awareness of our body is not given to us by just the feelings in the fingers and the legs and the back and so on. We're not given that information just from the outposts of the body. It's because of a map in the brain that tells us what our body is like that we experience the body the way we do. And with Marion, who we just heard from, her brain map tells her she still has the missing arm. She even feels that she squashes it if she rolls over at night in bed.
This is an expectation from her brain.
This is an expectation that everything is well. She still sends out signals to move her arm, and so without getting information back to tell her it didn't move, she thinks she has moved. She feels as though the arm is functioning normally.
So how does someone treat a condition like that?
Well, it's very difficult because she's getting contradictory information. As she says, in the morning, she feels she has two arms and she has to look to see which arm is missing. So she's getting visual information that says the arm isn't there, but she's getting proprioceptive information, feeling her fingers, able to move them and wiggle them. And so there's a conflict between the information she's getting from her senses, and that's very disturbing to people. What's odd is that the brain doesn't simply resolve that in favor of how things look. It shows you that the brain map is actually dominating and going to give you the strongest sense of who you are and where your limbs are.
Let's go on to one of my favourite mixed up wirings in the brain. This is synesthesia. Here's another clip from the programme.
I think Claire can see consonants in colour, and I can only see vowels in colour. So Tuesday would look a bit of yellow and a bit of brown.
You can't have a mixture.
Yes, you can. You can mix your paints.
I mean, if I said to you, I mean, my name, Claire, what colour is that?
Ah, well, when you were born, I put an I into the Claire, which actually complicates it. Mm-hmm. Because the A is black and the I is sort of whitish yellow. The black in the A and the sort of yellowish white in the I, they remain distinct, but they make up some slightly other colour.
So synesthesia there, this idea that what people see words as colours and vice versa, maybe even smell things whenever a word or something is said. And it's fascinating, the stories people tell about this stuff, because often when people don't know they have it until very late in their lives, because they think that everyone has this sort of condition. Can you just explain what it is and what's going on?
Yes, people are quite surprised when it's pointed out this is unusual. They think that's normal experience.
It's normal to see a certain word is red or blue.
Perfectly normal. Yeah. I mean, it's just how the word is. Five is yellow or blue, and that's a normal experience. So what's interesting there is the way in which the brain is making extra connections. Now, we've seen in the case of experiencing flavor how the brain has to make connections between taste and touch and smell and perhaps sight, and fuse these things into a single experience. What we think goes on in synesthesia is that the brain is making extra links. It's going outside the usual pattern of connections. And in the case of Claire Balderson, who we just heard of, it's the very familiar synesthesic condition of hearing or imagining colours with words. What we don't usually come across, but can happen, is unusual cases such as the man who experiences the tastes of foods as shapes in his hand. Now here the connections have become very, very remote and very different from the sorts of things we have. But the question's got to be, why aren't more of us like this? Why don't we make all of these connections ourselves?
Is this something that they would want to fix? Or is this something that's just part of their experience and they think, well, you know, I've got a richer experience of the world than you?
This is part of their experience. And in fact, they're quite annoyed that we don't have it. And they think there's something rather odd with us. How could we fail to see that eating a piece of lemon is a sharp, angular shape in the hand? Now, what's interesting is that synesthesia, the making of connections, can have positive benefits. So one thing that neuroscientists now believe is that the use of metaphor, the fact that people will put things together in unusual and interesting ways in speech, this may be an extension of synesthesia. This may be a way in which you're able to connect ideas or connect objects in a quite unusual form. And of course, lots of writers, musicians, and artists have had synesthesia.
Now, we've been dancing around the big subject all of this time, and it's consciousness. Neuroscientists with better technology, better understanding of the brain, better physical understanding are starting to get to the edges of something that we may never understand altogether. But how far are we to working out what consciousness even might be?
Well, I think we've got better at asking the question. So for a start, we don't think consciousness is just one thing. It's not a light bulb being on or off. We think there are levels of consciousness. We think there are different unities of consciousness. And instead of asking the question that has bothered philosophers, you know, how can this 1.5 kilograms of soggy grey matter in our head make us conscious? We still don't know the answer to that. The better question is to ask which parts of the brain and which functions are responsible for specific kinds of experiences. And we're finding out some really quite remarkable things about that question, namely that parts of the brain we thought wouldn't be involved in, say, recognizing a face or tasting a peach are actually active, showing us how complicated the story is about putting conscious experience together.
We can, I mean, understand some more of this stuff with recent research where patients in comas or other sort of situations where the consciousness levels have been radically altered. So, for example, a few years ago, we had an experiment where a scientist looked at the brain of someone in a persistent vegetative state. And I think you did the same experiment.
Yes, we've looked at the work of Adrian Owen, who has asked whether or not people who are in persistent vegetative state, who don't respond to external stimuli, who for many of us would seem to have some kind of brain damage or near unawareness of the world around them, whether or not there's a minimal level of consciousness in which they're still able to think and respond to questions.
We'll talk about that in just a sec. Let's hear a clip of you in the experiment.
Okay, Barry, we're going to try and ask you a question now. I don't know the answer to this question. I've just been given it by Dave, your producer. The question I'm going to try and get the answer to is, have you ever been to Brazil? Now, if the answer to that question is yes, when you hear me say the word answer, I want you to imagine playing tennis. If the answer to the question is no, when you hear me say the word answer, I want you to imagine moving from room to room in your house. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay, so answer. Rest. Answer. So at the moment, we're seeing no activity in his parahippocampal gyrus, but we're seeing lots of activity in his premotor cortex, which would indicate that he's imagining playing tennis and he's conveying a yes.
So, Barry, you were in a scanner there. Tell us what was happening.
So what I was doing there was demonstrating the technique Adrian Owen uses to elicit answers from people in persistent vegetative state. He asks them to imagine playing tennis, and when he does, the premotor cortex strip lights up. This lights up just by imagining yourself playing tennis and waving your arms around.
Even imagining moving will engage the moving parts of your brain.
In normal subjects, just imagining moving and thrashing your arms around will immediately light up the supplementary motor area. Now, when that happens, Adrian Owen has been able to ask people to imagine playing tennis if the answer is yes, and to imagine something different moving around their house if the answer is no. And he has found out that in some of these patients, very few, but in some of these patients, if he asks them questions like, do you have brothers? Have you been to the USA? They can give a perfectly correct response by imagining playing tennis by just lighting up that part of the brain.
I mean, this raises all sorts of ethical questions about, you know, treatment of people in these sorts of states, persistent vegetative states, where you don't know what sort of experience they're having, whether they're in pain.
Well, I think what's interesting here is that the ethical questions are left just as they are. I mean, perhaps we can ask them, are they in pain? And often they answer by saying no, but we can't check that. We don't know whether or not that's true. But you might wonder whether you should have practical concern for people who still have this consciousness. You might also wonder whether they want to continue living if that's all the consciousness that they enjoy. The other thing I think is that you get answers, but in a very limited and very specific range of settings, you can get them to give yes or no answers. Perhaps in the next 10 years, we'll have a much broader sense of what we can elicit from them and what they're thinking about than just these limited questions.
And what about your own opinions about, for example, things like privacy? We're going to know lots more about the brain. We're going to be able to scan brains and work out if someone... I'm kind of going well into the future here, but if someone's telling a lie about something or not, who should own this information? I mean, this is a bit like DNA now, isn't it?
It is a little.
There's actions instead.
There's something a little bit scary here because you get a much better lie detector test. I mean, for example, perhaps you want to know whether a suspected criminal has been to a crime scene. And if you could scan them by showing them pictures of that scene, you might get information that shows they clearly recognize the building or the room which they said they've never been to before. So yes, more information can be elicited. So it has to be used very carefully.
Okay. We'll leave that there for now, though. Stay there, Barry. We're going to get your opinions on the next section of the podcast about whether we can actually ever know everything about the brain. You can hear more from Barry Smith in The Mysteries of the Brain, a four-part series in the BBC's World Service, starting this week, Monday the 20th. Of September. Go to bbc.co.uk/worldservice for more info. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, go to @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all of the Guardian Science content, follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Will there ever be a point in time where mankind will understand everything? Russell Stannard doesn't think so. The Emeritus Professor of Physics at the Open University disagrees with the likes of fellow physicist Stephen Hawking that we're close to a theory of everything. Stannard is a high-energy nuclear physicist, as well as a regular contributor to Thought for the Day on Radio 4's Today programme. He believes that some things are just too taxing for our little minds. That's the message of his new book, The End of Discovery. We called up Professor Stannard and asked him whether there's ever going to be a point in time where we say, well, that's it. We finally figured everything out.
I think there's going to come a time when we have, in fact, or our descendants have, in fact, discovered everything about the world that is open to us to understand. But whether they will know that they've come to the end is another matter, because that they'll be faced, as we are faced today, with many questions. And you know, just as we hope to be able to answer some of those questions, so will they. But there's no way of proving that there is going to be no answer to a question.
So I think what's going to happen is that there won't be, you know, some sort of triumphal end to science where everyone says, OK, that's it, we've wrapped it up. I think science will go out with a whimper rather than a bang. And you'll just get into a situation where for a very, very, very long time, nothing interesting happens. And people start to think, well, becoming a research scientist is probably not a good career move.
Part of your argument clearly is that there may be things that are beyond the reach of human knowledge. Well, in the first instance, practical considerations. We may just not be able to build a particle accelerator big enough.
Yes, yeah, so, you know, already there is a favourite theory, string theory, which is associated with the M theory that Stephen Hawking has been talking about recently, where the assumption is that the constituents, the ultimate constituents of matter, are not tiny bits of dirt. They're actually vibrating strings. And if you make that assumption, then it's a very attractive theory. The trouble is that one expects that these strings are going to be so tiny that you would need a Large Hadron Collider the size of a galaxy in order to be able to see them. So clearly, for purely, you know, practical reasons, one is not going to be able to verify that these strings are there. Also, these strings are supposed to be vibrating in 10 spatial dimensions, but we only know about 3 spatial dimensions. And the theory says, well, perhaps the other 7 are all curled up very, very tiny. But again, it's believed that they will be so tiny that, again, you will not be able to see them. M theory postulates that it's capable of producing universes. It produced this universe, but also many, many other universes. Well, again, by definition, you're not going to be able to detect those other universes. Otherwise, they would be part of this universe. So already in science, we've got into a situation where it begins to look as though we might be foiled in a complete theory of everything simply from practical considerations. And then, of course, on top of that, there are the possible limitations to the human brain and what we are capable of grasping, you know, the kinds of questions that we are capable of formulating with our brain.
I mean, we as humans evolved in Africa to run away from big predators, we assume, and to reproduce. And so we didn't evolve to deal with these more profound questions about our place in the universe.
It was all a question of, as you say, avoiding predators, finding food, finding a mate, finding shelter, you know, competition for that sort of business. And so it's all about surviving to a point where you can mate and pass on your genes. Well, already we have managed somehow to go a long way further than that, because knowing about the Big Bang and knowing about DNA doesn't help you to survive to a point where you can mate. So it is remarkable that we've managed to do what we have done, but I think we have to be very careful not to get carried away, as I'm afraid some scientists are, in thinking that, okay, the brain is capable of understanding absolutely everything. It was never produced for that, so why should anybody expect it to be able to do that?
But we do have technology, and we do have a symbiotic relationship with technology, and we already outsource computing problems to computers. They do the sums that we can't cope with in our own brains. So couldn't we do more of that in the future? Aren't we already involved in some form of sort of directed evolution rather than classic Darwinian evolution?
Well, certainly computers are able to help us, for example, to do calculations which are far more, would take us unaided much, much longer. It speeds up our thinking processes. I think that is the main characteristic of computers. It does things that we can normally do anyway, but it does them very, very much faster. And so certain things which would be impossible for us to do simply because it would just take too long and too much effort. Computers are able to do that. But computers can only do what we, namely our brains, tell them to do. And if you're doing fundamental science, what you're trying to do all the time is to come up with new thoughts. Well, I can't see how a computer is going to be able to come up with some absolutely fresh way of looking at things unless it's been programmed to do that.
And you talk in the book about sort of age-old questions that we seem to be no nearer to answering, like free will and determinism, and problems of human consciousness. Do you think they will simply remain outside the realm of science, as it were?
Yes, I think that certain questions like those have been around for so long now, and the finest minds have been taxed by these questions. The greatest philosophers have been thinking about these things, and yet, despite all that effort over such a long period of time, there really has been no progress. Or very little progress. And so I think not only that, but there's something about the quality of those questions which make one suspect that perhaps we're barking up the wrong tree. We're not going to be able to get an answer to them. When one thinks, we have two sort of languages. There's the physical language, which is based on concepts like electron and mass and electric charge and stuff like that. And then we have a mental language, the language of consciousness, which talks about love, pain, fear. Well, I cannot see how qualities like love, pain, and fear will ever be quantified and find themselves into a physics equation along with other terms which relate to electric charge and mass and so on. So I can't see how you're ever going to get a unified theory, just a simple, single way of looking at things which encapsulates everything we know about what it is to be human. I think we're going to be stuck with this business of gaining some insight into what it is to be human by talking about our physical bodies, in particular our brain, and a completely different set of insights which come from adopting a totally different language, which is the language of the mind. It's messy, but I don't see how we're going to get around that.
Just to go back to Stephen Hawking, I mean, really your book is talking then about the end of scientific discovery, whereas he seems to be, or at least I haven't actually read the book, the headlines seem to be saying that Hawking's says science, we're going to solve it all with M-theory.
Yes, well, I would say that that philosophy of Hawking's is precisely the one that my book is trying to counter. I think that his views, as have been reported, are a perfect example of what we call scientism, that science is the only route to knowledge, and that ultimately we shall have a complete understanding of absolutely everything. Now, that, I think, is nonsense. And I think it's dangerous nonsense, because it alienates the public from science. It makes us sound, and some scientists actually are, exceedingly arrogant. And that gets up people's noses and is quite unjustified. You see, as the backlash against Hawking's pronouncements point out, that it's all very well saying that the universe came as a result of spontaneous creation due to M theory. But that only raises the question, well, where does M theory come from? Why are there physical laws, intelligible physical laws? And I think that science is always going to remain a description of the way things are without ever having a clue as to how to state why there is something in the first place. The question, why is there something rather than nothing, usually means, no, why is there a world rather than nothing? But if M theory is correct, then we simply have to change that slightly to say, well, okay, the reason is there is M theory, but why is there something rather than nothing? But the something is M theory. Why is there M theory? Why are there physical laws? And that takes you out of science.
Professor Russell Stannard there, speaking to the Observer's Casper Llewellyn-Smith. Russell's book, The End of Discovery, is out now. Barry, before we wind up, Russell doesn't seem very optimistic about the ability of humanity to understand, you know, everything. I mean, I'm talking about, we touched on things like consciousness before. What's your sort of take on things?
Well, I'm glad to say that this is one case where philosophers got there first. So about 10 years ago, philosopher Colin McGinn already argued that perhaps the problem of consciousness was just too complicated for our brains. We have kind of bounded limits on what we can understand. This is called cognitive closure, and that we can't get beyond it. So McGinn thought that roughly consciousness was to us what nuclear physics was to the chimpanzee, and that it would just always be beyond us. Now, that's very pessimistic. Question is whether or not we should accept that. We don't have answers, we don't have explanations yet, but if there are explanations to be had, let's not give up too soon.
But I mean, I suppose the limit you reach is that you're trying to understand the phenomenological impact of neurons in your brain with those very tools. So can you ever go, don't you have to go outside that tool to understand the thing you're looking at?
Well, that tool gives us huge range to all sorts of things that are outside it, most of the rest of the world, and certainly a lot of scientific theorizing, language, mathematics, and so on. We use all of that to try to explain.
So you're a bit more optimistic than Russell.
Oh, much more optimistic. I mean, it's crazy to think that we couldn't explain language because we're having to explain it in language. These are not mysterious puzzles. We just have to be very careful about what we're doing.
You're speaking to the wrong people. Some people have troubles explaining language in language. Trust me. There's a link to all of that stuff on our Facebook group. Search for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. That's it for this week. Thanks to Barry Smith. His series on the mysteries of the brain begins on Monday, September the 20th on the BBC World Service. Thanks also to Professor Russell Stannard. Next week, it's all about Aston University in Birmingham. Yes, the British Science Association's annual roadshow is back on, well, the road. We might well have some reports if there's anything worth, well, reporting on. It'll also be a podcast for people with a paranoia of touching things. Dr. Anthony Hilton will be asking, yes, but is it as dirty as a toilet seat? Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And also check out our science blogs at guardian.co.uk/scienceblogs. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.